Pakistani press was allowed on multiple occasions to approach family members closely, harass and hector them.
India takes issue with what the Pakistan government calls a humanitarian gesture. This is Wednesday, December 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. We'd like you to be part of this program. Please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, China tries its hand at ironing out differences between Pakistan and Afghanistan. We take a closer look at what the ever more powerful Chinese leader means to his country and the world. And the most money ever has been paid at auction for the works of a Chinese artist. It's all on today's VOA Asia. We have a number of stories today that involve Pakistan, and in our opinion, all bear great importance. We'll get to the story about what drove India to criticize what had been termed by Pakistan a humanitarian issue in just a few moments. But first, Chinese diplomacy apparently has succeeded in persuading Afghanistan to begin a wide-ranging dialogue proposed by Pakistan for mending strained bilateral relations. The decision came at Tuesday's first trilateral talks hosted by Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi between his Pakistani and Afghan counterparts. Last month, Islamabad shared with Kabul what is called an Afghanistan-Pakistan Action Plan for Solidarity, or APAPS, for a constructive and meaningful engagement between the two countries. This proposed plan, say officials, would create working groups in politics, economics, the military, intelligence sharing, and issues related to Afghan refugees in Pakistan. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Khwaja Asif told a joint news conference at the trilateral talks that there is a response now from our brothers in Afghanistan.
Pakistan emphasized the importance of border management, return of Afghan refugees, and intelligence sharing for effective counterterrorism cooperation. We look forward to response to our proposal for the Afghan-Pakistan Action Plan for Solidarity and for early operationalization of 5 working groups.
Asif said, I think things will start moving on the formation of the 5 groups on different topics entailed in this proposal, and there will be progress on the proposal. Asif didn't elaborate and credited China for the headway made on the proposed dialogue with Kabul. Without directly commenting on remarks made by his Pakistani counterpart, the Afghan Foreign Minister Salahuddin Rabbani praised Beijing for arranging Tuesday's dialogue and said that China has very good relations with both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Afghanistan firmly believes that improving state-to-state relations, enhancing mutual trust, and utilizing opportunities for deepening cooperation on the basis of mutual respect and mutual benefit between Afghanistan and Pakistan not only serves the interests of the two neighbors, but also contribute to regional peace, stability, and development.
Rabbani added that Afghanistan will host the second round of the 3-way meeting in the first half of next year, and we hope that we will make more progress, he said. You'll hear more on the other major stories involving Pakistan when we check in with VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad in just a moment. Stay with us on VOA Asia, and we invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, and we're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. The U.S. sanctions 2 North Korean officials over that country's missile program. China seemingly brokers new Afghanistan-Pakistan talks. India accuses Pakistan of harassing a convicted spy's family. Pakistan's army says Indian fire kills 3 soldiers in Kashmir. And the North Korea UN ambassador demands that the U.S. prove its ransomware claim. Expanded coverage of these stories and other stories are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. As promised, we now welcome VOA's Ayaz Gul to VOA Asia. Our longtime Pakistan correspondent is in Islamabad. Ayaz, several other stories are making headlines around the world. I'll leave it for you to explain it all.
All of the developments that have taken place over the past 24 hours are very important and reflect the kind of tensions that have been gripping South Asia, particularly the India-Pakistan region. And the most important development happened a day earlier when Pakistan arranged a meeting of an Indian death row prisoner, Kulbhushan Yadav, who was arrested in Pakistan a year ago, and then he was tried for espionage and organizing terrorism against Pakistan. But for the first time, at the request of his family, through the diplomatic channels that India used, Pakistan provided issued visas to Kulbhushan Yadav's wife and his mother, and they arrived in Islamabad, and a special meeting was arranged, obviously under the supervision of Pakistani officials, although there was an Indian diplomat standing there, but he wasn't able to listen to the conversation that Kulbhushan Yadav had with his wife and mother, but he could see them, and that is how Pakistanis defended this whole situation, that because Kulbhushan Yadav has been sentenced to death and that he has been involved in acts of terrorism against Pakistan, so there was no provision under any diplomatic understanding that would allow a consular access for India to meet this guy. So in order to protect its own interests, Pakistanis made sure that only the family of this convict, Kulbhushan Yadav, meets him. But then we obviously saw a reaction. This is how the Indian Foreign Minister, Sushma Swaraj, reacted to the meeting that happened here in Islamabad a day earlier.
The Pakistani press was allowed on multiple occasions to approach family members closely, harass and hector them, and hurt false and motivated accusations about Sri Yadav. This was despite a clear agreement that the media would not be allowed close access.
But while this, as you know, while this meeting was taking place, just hours after this meeting took place on Monday, Pakistani military issued a statement that Indian border forces along the de facto border in Kashmir opened fire at a Pakistani security outpost and killed three soldiers and wounded one more. And Pakistan complained. Obviously, today they summoned the Indian Deputy High Commissioner to the Foreign Ministry, and a protest was formally lodged, where the Pakistani officials insisted that while Islamabad demonstrated this goodwill gesture by allowing the family of Kulbhushan Yadav to meet him, India responded by initiating unprovoked firing across the Kashmir border and killed these three soldiers. But then there is a reason for the Indians to defend their action, and they did openly defended their action, because 2 days earlier it was New Delhi which came out and protested and said that Pakistani border forces in Kashmir, in the same region, initiated fire in violation of a so-called ceasefire in the Himalayan region and killed four Indian soldiers, including a senior officer. And apparently what happened to the Pakistani soldiers was a revenge attack from the Indian side.
Ayaz, you've been covering this for many a year, and nothing seems to change as far as the tensions between Pakistan and India are concerned.
Well, that is the sad part of this whole story, and there is no hope that this issue is going to be resolved. In fact, as a result of these current skirmishes and clashes on the border, there are serious worries that they can escalate into a major conflict between the two countries. And these three wars that Pakistan and India have fought over the last 60, 70 years were conventional wars. But since then, since the last war that was in 1971, both the countries have achieved nuclear capabilities and they are now armed with nuclear weapons. And the fear is that any future conflict, even if it is a conventional conflict, is likely to escalate into a nuclear exchange. And that is why there's a lot of worry, but we don't see any hope that the two countries are any closer to even resuming some kind of diplomatic negotiation.
That's VOA's Ayaz Ghul joining us from Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. This is VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, the United States has imposed sanctions on two North Korean officials for their role in Pyongyang's ballistic missile program. A Treasury Department statement said Kim Jong-sik and Ri Pyong-kol are key leaders of North Korea's unlawful weapons programs. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. In 2017, China's Xi Jinping rose to become the country's most powerful leader in decades. And as he shoulders more responsibility, analysts say the government in Beijing is likely to take more risks in 2018 at home and overseas, even as it deals with economic challenges at home, a nuclear North Korea, and the looming threat of trade tensions with the United States. VOA's Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide has this report.
Xi Jinping is the core leader of the Communist Party, and like Mao Zedong, his name and political thought is now written into the party's constitution. As head of the world's second-largest economy, he is leading a push to sell what he calls the China Solution, Beijing's effort to help solve the world's financial and political uncertainties. In 2018, analysts such as David Kelly, head of research at the Beijing-based group China Policy, see him continuing to seize opportunities overseas as they arise.
There's a window of opportunity internationally created by the Trump administration and Brexit and a few other things, Middle East. And despite the risks seen, for example, in Pakistan with a building of ports and infrastructure, they basically doubled down.
The thinking among China's Communist Party leadership, Kelly adds, is that now is the time to act. China's trillion-dollar strategic and trade program, the Belt and Road Initiative, includes projects like a multi-billion-dollar deep-sea port in Gwadar, Pakistan, and an economic corridor through that country, which is plagued by terrorist threats. But there has been pushback there against the program in Pakistan as well as other Chinese policies in the region. Beijing's military expansion of man-made islands continues in the South China Sea, but China is also showing flexibility as it works on a code of conduct, analysts say. Yang Kai-huang, a political science professor at Taiwan's Mingquan University, says Beijing's approach is both principled and flexible. Yang says countries, including China, have to get used to different levels of engagement in many different aspects with the prioritized goal of avoiding major conflicts and wars. Yang says the world, including China, has come to that common understanding. North Korea remains a huge uncertainty for China, where Beijing has shown an ability over the past year to take riskier moves, such as adopting tougher sanctions, as Pyongyang continues to test the international community. This has meant working closer at times with Washington, even as the threat of a possible trade war with the United States looms overhead. China Policy's Kelly says there is much uncertainty. And even more challenging than China's own fault lines is the Trump administration, he adds.
If you've got risk economics and risky politics together, then you don't just have two times the risk, you've got the risk squared.
At home, Xi's power also brings opportunities and risk as well. With his increased power and general sense that he was successful during his first 5 years in office, expectations from the public and the risk of failure will both be higher, Yang says. Yang says if those in Xi's leadership team make mistakes or handle issues inappropriately, the public will feel that he has not made good choices, and he'll bear complete responsibility. A recent uproar over the forced eviction of migrant workers in Beijing and backlash over a plan to force residents in the northeast to shift away from coal In the cold of winter, even before much of the infrastructure was finished, are two recent examples. Analysts say that while cronies of Xi, such as Beijing's party secretary Tai Chi, managed to wiggle out of those challenges largely unscathed, both highlight how the stakes and expectations are higher. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
This is VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov told his American counterpart Tuesday that Washington's aggressive rhetoric has heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula, according to the Russian Foreign Ministry. In a telephone call between Lavrov and U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Lavrov called U.S. rhetoric unacceptable. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia.
For VOA's business scene, I'm Skylar Ogden. Chinese artist Qi Baishu has set a new record with a set of his landscapes selling for 931.5 million yuan, or 140 million U.S. dollars at a Beijing auction. The amount paid for the ink wash paintings that were completed in 1925 by the Hunan-born artist, who was most commonly known for his calligraphy and brush painting, was the most money ever paid for the work of a Chinese artist. Chao Shu, executive director of the Beijing Poly International Auction, said the $140 million sale makes Qi one of the world's most valued Chinese artists, whose works now command prices on par with the likes of Andy Warhol and Pablo Picasso.
It has been in the hands of private collectors and not open to the public, so it is not easy to put it on auction. Moreover, each painting depicts the artist's hometown. Thus, it is Qi's most important and biggest work.
Chinese art is primarily bought and sold within the country, and much of it includes Chinese painting and calligraphy. The sale was made at Poly Auction Beijing, a leading state-owned auction house in China. Poly Auction has refused to reveal the buyer's identity. Preliminary work has begun on India's first undersea tunnel, one that will provide a route for the proposed Mumbai-Ahmedabad bullet train, as well as an economic push for Japan into the Indian economy. Achal Khare, the managing director of the National High-Speed Rail Corporation, which is heading the project, says completion of the tunnel, which will be constructed 25 to 40 meters under the seabed, is scheduled for August 15, 2022. While 7 kilometers of the tunnel is under Thane Creek, 1.8 kilometers will be under the sea. The rest will go under the mangroves marshlands on either side of the creek, according to corporation officials. The tunnel is likely to cost almost $17 billion. Of that, Japan is providing 81% of the funding for the $16.9 billion project. The project will strengthen economic ties between the two countries and help to counterbalance China's growing influence in the region. The bullet train is expected to reduce travel time between the two cities from 8 hours to just about 3 hours. For VOA's business scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news alert from VOA Asia. The Philippines said on Tuesday it would investigate whether safety regulations were ignored at an office where a fire killed 37 call center employees and vowed to impose sanctions if firms had not met standards. The remains of 37 employees of the U.S.-based Research Now SSI killed by Saturday's fire in Davao City have been recovered, and a criminal investigation will be launched by the Justice Department. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now with VOA Asia. A prominent Chinese human rights activist has been sentenced to 8 years in prison on charges of subversion. Wu Gan, who's a blogger who goes by the nickname of Super Vulgar Butcher, believe it or not, was sentenced Tuesday in the Tianjin No. 2 Intermediate People's Court in Beijing. Wu, who was arrested in May of 2015 in southeastern China, gained notoriety for mocking Chinese political officials in a long-running campaign against corruption and abuse of power. The court ruled that Wu tried to overthrow state power and the socialist system through a series of what they called criminal actions, including spreading false information and insulting people online. Wu Gan is among the hundreds of human rights activists and lawyers swept up in a massive government crackdown on dissent, dubbed the 709 crackdown, that began in earnest in July of 2015. Wu's lawyer says his client will appeal the verdict. In a separate case Tuesday, a court in central China exempted human rights lawyer Shi Yang from serving any time in jail after convicting him on charges of inciting subversion of state power. Shi was arrested in 2015 and detained for 2 years before being released on bail in May. Shortly before his release, Shi claimed he was tortured during his long detention, including repeated beatings. He has since denied those allegations. A North Korean ambassador to the United States says the U.S. claim that Pyongyang was behind the WannaCry ransomware attack earlier this year is a baseless provocation and demanded Washington back up its accusations with evidence. The North's U.N. ambassador in charge of U.S.-related issues says North Korea believes Washington is using the allegation to create an extremely confrontational atmosphere. Pang Sung-il told the Associated Press in a telephone interview from New York late Monday, if they're so sure, just show us the evidence. Coastal communities around the world depend on coral reefs for food, storm protection, and tourism, but many reefs are suffering under the onslaught of climate change. Scientists are fighting back, however. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Off the coast of Miami, divers are staking twigs of coral to the ocean bottom. These twigs were clipped from the University of Miami's coral nursery. Scientists working to restore degraded reefs recently discovered that corals grow faster when they're cut into smaller pieces, says project manager Dalton Hesley.
We can take a large boulder coral, fragment into a lot of small coin-sized pieces, increase their growth, and then fuse them back together to create a larger coral colony than we started with in a fraction of the time.
Branching corals like these work especially well. Hesley says the lab started 9 years ago with 30 finger-sized fragments.
We've turned those into over 3,500 in our coral nursery. So that means any day of the week we can collect hundreds of these staghorn and elkhorn corals to transplant onto local reefs as a natural way to promote growth and recovery.
The group has transplanted more than 11,000 corals so far. But those corals face the same warming oceans that are killing reefs in many parts of the world. Hesley's group does not want their efforts to go to waste. That's why they're working with their University of Miami colleague, Andrew Baker.
So that instead of planting out the next set of coral victims, we're actually planting out corals that we think are going to be more heat tolerant in the future.
Corals get their food and their bright colors from algae partners called symbionts. But when the water gets too warm, they lose the algae. These bleached corals cannot live for long. But, Baker adds,
it actually provides an opportunity for corals to potentially change their algal symbionts and become sort of colonized by new types of algae that are maybe more suited to the new environment.
Baker's lab is stressing out corals and selecting the ones that recover best.
Despite having been really severely bleached just a couple of months ago, they've actually recovered really well, and you can see that they've started to grow new branches.
The next step will be to plant stress-hardened corals on degraded reefs and see how they do. The team is optimistic that they can give the reefs a fighting chance, but they know there's only so much they can do.
We can't rebuild every reef around the globe, so that's why education is the second biggest part of our program and our efforts.
They recruit volunteers to help rebuild the reefs. They teach them about the need for global solutions to climate change, and they hope these citizen scientists will help spread the word. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Miami.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Let's hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and our email at voaasia@voaasia.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Dan Crafton, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our team, Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, and Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Have a wonderful day.